This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In a moment here, we'll be talking with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice here, the Women's Health Practice in Champaign-Urbana. She teaches the U of I Med School, and for a long time now, on a regular basis, she's been here on the program to talk about women's health, and we will do that in just a little bit. Just a moment ago here, Jay was talking about the kind of special day that we've set aside both to celebrate the coming of summer and to encourage people to support the station. And throughout the day, we'll be trying to do some things that hook into that theme. And I certainly want to mention that 1 week from today, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking with Rick Moonen. He is the chef and owner of RM Seafood in Las Vegas. He's also a food writer and is the co-author of a new book, a really nice cookbook that has just come out that's titled Fish Without a Doubt, The Cook's Essential Companion. Maybe now here over the summertime you're thinking about doing a little thing more, some things more with seafood. Maybe you're thinking about putting them on the grill. Just yesterday morning on the show, we were talking with someone who's written a book that raises concern about eating fish and particular kinds of fish. So maybe what you, after having heard that, you'd like some to have some suggestions for cooking different kinds of fish or cooking in a different way. We talk about any and all of that with Rick Moonen. That's a week from today in the 10 o'clock hour. And then in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk about Midwest travel. Summertime is a time for travel. And these days, for people are maybe thinking about trying to stay a little closer to home because of the cost of travel and certainly the cost of motor fuel. And we'll have two guests for that show, Trevor Mears, who is the executive editor of Midwest Living, and also Barbara Morrow, the senior travel editor at Midwest Living. So I'm sure that they'll be able to answer questions and perhaps also have some suggestions on places that you can go that are close. Maybe you could, if you're not going too far, maybe you could actually think about doing this in the car. Or maybe that's the kind of thing you can do on the train. Who knows? We'll talk about that coming up. That's 1 week from today in this hour, in the 11 o'clock hour of the show. That's for our Friday fun celebration for summer. Well, here in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about women's health, which is something that we do every other month on the program, and generally on a Monday, but this time around, the Monday was a holiday. We weren't here, and we did not want to go. Now, it would have been going 2 months without doing this topic, so we asked Dr. Truppen if she would come at a different time, and she said, yeah, sure, she could do that. So we're pleased once again to welcome back to the show Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area, the Women's Health Practice, and also she teaches at the U of I College of Medicine. Here in Urbana-Champaign, and we're open to questions. And now she usually comes prepared to talk about maybe a few things that are new in her field or that are in the news. But also, the idea behind doing the program is to give listeners a chance to ask questions. So you can call in and talk about anything that has to do with her particular area of practice. And we've talked a lot of things in the past. We've talked about things like family planning and pregnancy. We've talked about osteoporosis. We have talked about menopause, a lot of other sorts of things. Any and all of that is certainly welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. So the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So that's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you got questions, you can give us a call. Welcome back.
Well, good morning. Thank you.
So are there some particular things that you'd maybe like to talk about?
Sure. My midwife has been at her national meeting, or my midwives have been at their national meeting, and my PA was at her national meeting, so I've been kind of wearing a few hats. And but they've all had all kinds of news and learning new things, so it's been kind of exciting. And speaking of contraception, they have really released a lot of new information about intrauterine devices, and we now, of course, have a medicated intrauterine device for contraception, as well as a copper-containing intrauterine device. And we've had some new guidelines that were released a couple of years ago regarding the contraceptive use of an IUD, allowing women who have not had a child to be a candidate for IUD use. And when patients come in saying they're thinking about not having more children, I tell them that an IUD is an excellent alternative because if you look over a 10-year period of time, which the Paragard copper-containing device is approved for, over after that first year, when we see a few expulsions, the success rate for contraception protection is identical. And so it allows you that flexibility of changing your mind about having a child, whereas sterilization actually has about a 20% regret rate. And so many people do not know that. And also many people do not know that IUDs are perfectly acceptable for people who have not had a child. And now they have released new information that IUD use is associated with a 40% reduction risk of endometrial cancer, that is lining cancer of the uterus. And it's virtually identical to the protection against endometrial cancer that women have from taking birth control pills. So that's fairly dramatic. And I think we talk about sort of the myth of the birth control pill being cancer-causing, even though it's actually cancer-protective. And again, IUDs, if you ask patients, are IUDs risk-producing, but they're actually risk-protecting? People think that IUDs can actually cause infection, but it's actually infectious agents that cause infection. And the progesterone-containing IUD does so much to decrease the amount of lining tissue of the uterus that you're actually protected against infection and protected against infections ascending up into the uterus. So an IUD is actually a very good alternative for contraceptive protection for many women. And I think that women should talk to their physicians about IUD use.
You know, just the other day, now this reminds me that I was reading a story in the, and I think this was in the Chicago Tribune. It was about unintended pregnancy, and the idea was that there were women that were not always faithfully using their method. You know, for example, women who took the contraceptive pill. If you said to them, now be honest, tell me the truth. Have you ever forgotten to take your pill? And that there are significant numbers of women who sort of say, oh, well, actually, yes, every once in a while I forget to take a pill. And you combine that with also things like there are still people who think that you can't get pregnant if you're having your period and you have intercourse, that you can't get pregnant if you're breastfeeding. And of course, that is not true.
Well, when we look at health behaviors, if you do the math, and we have 365 days a year. And yes, you have some days you don't need to take your pill in those pill-free intervals. But if you essentially do your math and you need to take pills most days of the year over a five-year period of time, you have to take 1,800 pills. So that's a lot of health behaviors, which is why when you compare even a patch, a contraceptive patch, which you only apply once a week, or a vaginal ring, the Nuva ring, which you can wear for 3 full weeks and then replace essentially monthly, those health behaviors are so much easier to comply with. And that's why we think the old 21-7 way of using birth control pills is going to pass away, because the 24-4 way of using pills, where you take pills for 24 active days and off for 4 days, is so much less likely to have breakthrough ovulations. Because if you do skip that, if the day you forget happens to be earlier in the cycle, you're more likely to have an escape ovulation. And in truth, you're more likely to have breakthrough bleeding. You're more likely to have abnormally low hormone levels. If you have abnormally low hormone levels due to a skipped pill, then if you are also given antibiotics, then that antibiotic dosage is more likely to interfere with your pills. And so those are reasons for failures. And we know that not every unplanned pregnancy is an unwanted pregnancy, but in the United States, we have about a 50% rate of unplanned pregnancy. And of unplanned pregnancy, about 50% of those do end in termination. So if we're going to decrease our termination rate in the United States, what we need to do is decrease that unplanned pregnancy rate.
Hmm. Well, that other aside from the IUD, are there other reasonable choices for women for some sort of a method where essentially they don't have to do anything. They don't have to remember to take their pill. They don't have to put a diaphragm in before having intercourse. They don't have to worry about, is the condom going to stay on, you know, all those sorts of things. There's nothing to do because the method is there and it's doing its thing.
Well, the other new method we have is the implanon. It's a progesterone rod. It's a single rod. We, a number of years ago, used to have the Norplant system. It was six rods, and they were very easy to insert, but a little bit difficult to remove because a capsule would form around each rod, and it took a tiny bit of surgical skill to remove the six rods. And the Norplant six rod system was good for 5 years. The implanon single rod system is good for 3 years, and it is rapidly becoming a very popular method of contraception. Like other progesterone methods, many women will cease having menstrual periods, so you have the side benefit of fewer menstrual cramps, fewer symptoms of premenstrual syndrome, and so forth. You need it inserted by a trained clinician. And locally, we have many trained clinicians as one of our local Planned Parenthood providers, Dr. Ann Robin, has been a trainer for Implanon, and so she trained many of us, including myself. And so you can go to the Implanon site and find out if they're local trained Implanon inserters, and we have many in our community throughout. You know, probably all the healthcare systems have them locally, so it's not hard to find a provider. And it's covered very well by many insurance companies, including Illinois Public Aid. And it's a great system. At the end of the 3 years, you get that rod removed. It's usually on the inside of your non-dominant arm. Very small little incision that heals up very quickly and does just tape down, a little cut that's taped down, don't need a stitch or anything like that. And then that rod's removed and another rod's inserted in the other direction. And it's an excellent system. And we still have the Depo-Provera shots. And in the 150 milligram dosage, you do need to get shots every 4 months. In the 104 milligram dosage, it's also approved for treatment of endometriosis, which I was in that clinical trial. And it's been a tried and true method and available for more than 50 years. And extremely effective as well.
Our guest this morning in this hour, Focus 580, is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign, has a practice here in our area. And every other month she's on the program. We talk about women's health. She usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new. But as I mentioned at the beginning, the idea here is that if you have questions about your health, you can take the opportunity to call in and discuss it with her. It's a way of getting more information and perhaps asking some basic questions. Obviously, we can't do diagnosis over the telephone, but questions are certainly welcome. We try to make it a good information resource for people. So if you'd like to talk with the doctor, 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, what else would you like to talk about?
Well, the FDA has just come out with some new guidelines for pregnancy medication labeling, and I'm very excited about this because the labeling for pregnancy medication risks has been very nonsensical and very difficult to follow. So right now we have medications in the United States that are labeled Category A, meaning they are quite safe in pregnancy, and then they have Category X, meaning they are extremely unsafe for use in pregnancy and can cause extreme harm and birth defects. And then we have this myriad of Category B, Category C, Category D, and that denotes various labels of risks for the fetus, and there's not a whole lot of information about the medication's risk for the mom in pregnancy, and usually medication risks for mom are not that different in pregnancy versus non-pregnant. Very often the problem is dilutional. We have about 4 liters of blood in an average woman's bloodstream, and when she becomes pregnant, her bloodstream expands to about 6 liters. So you get half again dilutional factor, and so medications often have to be adjusted to make sure they have a proper serum level so they'll be as effective in pregnancy as not in pregnancy. And the FDA is now going to simplify all of this and completely make this practical and useful to both clinicians and patients who are, quote unquote, in the real world. Usually, that's such a novel concept, because in medicine, most everything's not in the real world. And usually it's not only not in the real world, but it's couched in abbreviations and funny words that most of us can't understand to begin with. But they're going to carry 3 summaries that include information about any risk to the fetus and the effects on the disease of the mother and the baby, and list the supporting information, and then separately have a lactation section, which will be good.
You know, I hadn't, in fact, just earlier this morning was reading a story about this, and I was wanting more information. I was really wanting to know more because I was a little bit confused about whether what was the feeling that the way that drugs were classified before, either maybe not providing enough information.
Well, see, here's the thing: is Class A is just has in the past been, we know it's absolutely safe in pregnancy, and so few drugs really are Class A. So Class B drugs are pretty much, we think that they're safe in humans. At least there's no real data to say that they're not safe in humans. Class C is that there's data that's not really very safe in animals, so leading to suspicion that it's not very safe in humans. And Class D is there may be a study that shows it may not be safe in humans. In Australia and a few other places, they have a B2 where it's been pretty safe in humans, and there's reason to believe that whatever animal data is out there really shouldn't pertain to humans. So a lot of RC drugs are B2s elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, a lot of our antidepressants that women who conceive are on various antidepressants, and most of them are Class C. And that's been very, very difficult because you either have to get the patient immediately switched over to something that she's not been stabilized on in order to get her onto a Class B or get her off that medication altogether. So it's just been very difficult. And when you're on a Class C drug, it creates a lot of strain for the obstetrician and the patient. And so I think this will simplify. It will allow a lot of patients to feel comfortable staying on their medication because it will focus on the actual clinical data, not so much the animal data.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that it has become more of an issue as we have more and more people who are taking medications on a continuing basis, not just for the fact that they're ill, they have a particular problem, you give them the medicine, they get well, that's it, they stop taking it. We have people that are taking things and could indeed be on maintenance doses of medications and have been taking them and will take them for years and years and years, I suppose.
And more older mothers. We have many women very safely getting pregnant in their early to mid 40s. And on average, many of those moms, I think probably more than half, are on medications.
Well, that just, and now that you mention that, that just raises in my mind the question about what it is that has changed, and so that there was a time when I'm sure that women were actively discouraged from being pregnant, from becoming pregnant over 40. And you also, I think there was a time when you started thinking that as far as being, you know, having your first baby was concerned, that even once you were in your mid-30s, that was starting kind of late. And that the potential for, that was not to say that you couldn't have a fine pregnancy, you'd be fine, the baby would be fine. But the concern, I think, was that the older the mom, the possibility that you would have a problem started to go up. What has changed?
Well, I think a variety of things have changed. We've gotten better at ovulation induction. We have better regimens that are succeeding now than used to succeed in the past. I think that's been helpful. I think the, you know, 40 is the new 30. I think that is very, very true. I think probably maybe the Sex and the City kinds of concepts that are probably true. I think that education is delaying many people from getting started on their family. So I think it's just due to a variety of circumstances and remarriages that is part of it. So I think it's a combination. Also, understanding how to successfully help patients who have various medical problems through their pregnancy, certain heart conditions, certain kidney conditions, certain asthma conditions, rheumatic diseases that we used to think of as prohibited for having safe pregnancies are no longer thought to be that way. Hmm. And through proper perinatal management, these patients have very successful pregnancies. Through advances in neonatal medicine, we are able to keep premature pregnancies, those premature babies, alive and healthy without long-term handicaps. So that has let people believe that they can go through a pregnancy more successfully. So I just think that it is due to a variety of circumstances, at least from where the obstetrician and the fertility physicians stand.
We're at our midpoint here, and we'd certainly welcome questions. We're talking this morning about women's health, something that we do every other month on the program, usually on a Monday. Had a little change of schedule this time around because we were off on Monday. And our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist with the Women's Health Practice. She also teaches at the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign, and she's here on a regular basis to answer questions. And if you do have questions about the specific things that she does in her practice about women's health, give us a call, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. What else you got?
Well, we have a new set of guidelines in terms of whether or not we should recommend medication treatment for osteopenia and osteoporosis. And not all the organizations that recommend medication treatment have adopted this system quite yet, but I suspect in the next 2 or 3 years we'll get everybody on board and maybe all these different organizations making the same recommendations. I think you and I talked about the differences in mammography guidelines for so many years, and I think now finally all the organizations have the similar guideline, and now we're still at that point with bone density guidelines, but I think the organizations are going to start moving together, so I'm excited about that. And the World Health Organization has come up with a fractal guideline, and on the National Osteoporosis Foundation website, you can click around a little bit and get there. And this is a screening tool where they factor in your age, your height and weight, some information regarding your health, some information regarding your family history of fractures and your own history of fractures, as well as your bone density score, and then come up with a treatment projection based on whether or not you're likely to have a hip fracture and whether or not you're likely to have any other osteoporotic fracture over the next 10 years. So they recommend treatment for people who are likely to have a 3% risk of a hip fracture or 20% or greater risk of any osteoporotic fracture over the next 10 years. So this is a little bit different than the guidelines that we've talked about recently. And of course, there are two philosophies here. One is strictly a preventative philosophy where some people believe you just treat everybody because some people are going to have fractures that really have no risk factors whatsoever, and the others are really strictly going based on risk factor. And I think that it's a great website to go to. They factor in your ethnicity as well, so you have to be sure you're using the algorithm for U.S. Caucasian, if you're Caucasian, and so forth. They'll ask you if you're male or female, so you can calculate your own score, David. And if you don't have a bone density, you can leave that part blank and still get a risk calculation based on some of those other factors. So it's very interesting to click around, and even a layperson can get a tremendous amount of information by working through the algorithm. And you have to be sure to convert your height and weight from pounds to kilograms, and from inches to centimeters.
And will it do that for you?
It will do that for you.
Good.
We'll do that for you. And but you have to do the conversion over the side, and then put the numbers in where they belong, or it will tell you you're making no sense. But us Americans, what can you do? But we've never converted over. But it is it's a good tool. I like these tools for people to work through, because as you work through, it brings home important points about the kinds of things that we think about. And in terms of bone health, it's not just what an absolute number is. It's what factors go into creating that number. And there's more to bone health than what that number is. And certainly balance is critical. So that's why your height, weight, and age is so important. Hmm. So if you just play with the numbers and give yourself an age of, say, 43 versus 53 versus 83, it's very interesting to see how that score changes. And it doesn't factor in how much you exercise, but that's a critical part of whether or not your balance is any good. And just try to stand on your right foot for a little while, and try to stand on your left foot for a little while, and try to do that with your eyes open and then with your eyes closed. And have a little bit of measurement of what your balance is, and you can improve your balance a lot through an exercise program or through a fitness instructor. And trying to improve your posture and your balance does so much for bone health. And of course, from my end, the medical end, improving your vitamin D and calcium status is critical as well. So if you are on medication and you haven't had your calcium level measured, and you haven't had your vitamin D level measured, and you haven't had your status of bone turnover looked into, you may need to think about these factors as well, because vitamin D status is very critical. And we are learning more and more about vitamin D. I think I've talked about this in the last few shows that I've had. And when I participate in research studies in osteoporosis, I think we had one study where over 20% of my healthy patients that were screened to come into a bone study were found not eligible because they didn't meet basic criteria for vitamin D blood levels. And one recent study showed that patients being currently treated for diabetes or pre-diabetic states also have insufficient vitamin D levels. So understanding what your vitamin D level is something very important to your current health.
Yeah. Just to remind people why that is important, vitamin D, it's important that you have adequate vitamin D because that plays a role in incorporating the calcium that you take in into your bones. That's why they put it in milk.
Well, yes. It actually, what it does is it helps absorb it. When you take your calcium in from your food, it helps take that calcium out of the GI tract into your bloodstream. And then from the bloodstream, the calcium gets into your bone. So if you are taking bone medicine and you don't have enough calcium in your bloodstream to take that calcium from your bloodstream into the bone, you can take that medicine, but it's worthless because the bones become strong from the calcium getting into the bone.
Okay, so that's why it's important. You have your vitamin D. So that's and
so
that's
you need
why
all those steps.
You need all those, and that's why often if people are going to take a calcium supplement, often that's going to have vitamin D already in there, just to make sure that you have both those things. And certainly that's why it's in multiple vitamins. That's why it's in milk. You can't just take your calcium. You'd have to make sure you have the appropriate amount of vitamin D.
Right. And we used to think that it was possible to OD on vitamin D. We don't really think that anymore because we used to recommend 200 international units and then we went up to 400 and now the guidelines are 800. And there have been some studies showing that for patients who have 2,000 units of vitamin D per day, they actually have health benefits. And in some younger patients, there was a study showing that if you get in 2,000 units of vitamin D a day, that you are less likely to even have MS. Hmm. So lots of side benefits from vitamin D.
Yeah. And I guess also we should, again, make the point that in addition to having the appropriate calcium, vitamin D, you've got to have some weight-bearing exercise, which doesn't mean you're going to go down to the gym and you're going to lift weights, but that you do indeed, walking can do the thing, but you do have to have regular exercise as well as a part of this, getting that calcium into your bones.
Right.
We have somebody here who has a question, and we'd certainly like to invite others. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have about 15 minutes left with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. That's our regular program on women's health. And if you have questions about anything that she's talked about so far or anything else that has to do with women's health, you can give us a call. We have someone here in Greenup to talk with. Line 4. Hello.
Dr. Truppen, I just turned on the radio, heard you talking about vitamin D. Should it be D3?
Well, that is an active form of vitamin D, and that is probably the best form of vitamin D to get in. And so that would be the best. And when we test blood levels of vitamin D, that's actually the best test to get, unless you've got some other condition where we need to test something different.
So we should look for 3 on the bottle of vitamin D.
Well, the different labels have it labeled oddly. You won't always see that specifically. So if you want to be sure you have the right amount, you just get that blood test for that specific type of vitamin D. And if your blood level is fine, you're fine.
Okay. I've heard the D is easier to absorb.
It is. It is.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, see, now I'm confused. I would figure, you know, vitamin D is vitamin D. You go there, you look on the shelf, it says vitamin D.
Not exactly.
Okay.
Just to mess you up.
So, all right. So, so then if I'm going to look for a vitamin D supplement.
I have to look. A lot of them now are labeled a little bit differently, and not all of them, I think, are specific. But most of when we test for vitamin D, we test for 125 hydroxy vitamin D, which is the D, it's nicknamed D3,
okay.
is the active form. And most of us can convert the different Ds to that.
Mm-hmm.
So most of us can effectively convert, but not all. And some of what happens is a lot of us do that conversion in our skin. But one of the reasons we become D deficient is we get older, that conversion process can't happen in our skin. So that's why we have to supplement. But a lot of I'll have to look at how all those are labeled, but they aren't all labeled as well.
Okay, so it sounds like the thing to do at the very least is when you go wherever you guys are going to buy your vitamins, don't just buy the first vitamin D you see. Take the time to read the labels and see what it says. Would even that not help?
What I usually, okay, this is my prejudice for my patients. Vitamins are so expensive.
Yeah.
I usually tell my patients to buy
the cheapest ones.
And then I like to do blood levels.
Uh-huh.
And so if their blood level isn't holding up, then I try to get fussy. But if their blood level's holding up, I'm good.
Okay.
And that's where the different types of calcium, yeah, when you do studies, some calciums are absorbed better than others. So if your calcium level isn't holding up, then I make them get, we tweak what kind of calcium they're getting. But if their calcium level's fine, it's fine.
Okay. Well, I suppose then if you have somebody who truly has osteoporosis or osteopenia, that and this is going to be more critical than someone who seems to be doing okay and doesn't have bone issues.
Or you can do it with dosage.
Uh-huh.
So you can bump the dose up as well as the as
the
form going
of the,
right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we have now about 15 minutes, and well, maybe more like 10, and we have a number of callers.
So I'll be short.
Okay. We'll get as many as we can. Next is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. Are you here?
Yes. Go ahead. Uh-huh.
Okay. He didn't tell me the line. I have this publication, Bone Health News. I'm sure it's an advertisement. It's out of Atlanta, Georgia. It's about strontium tablets. They label it Ultimate Bone Support. Do you know of any advantage to strontium compared with calcium?
Well, there is some evidence that various minerals will contribute, and most of those minor minerals you don't need a lot of, but there is some evidence that low doses of strontium will help.
All right, thank you.
All right, and next we'll talk with someone in Terre Haute. This is Savoy, line number four. Go ahead.
Yes, mm-hmm. I'd just like to ask Dr. Troopin if there is a limit on calcium intake, because I think I've read that if you get too much calcium in your blood that there could be negative effects.
Yes, and they've had all kinds of publications. There was recently a study showing too much calcium led to increased heart attacks. And this is why, really, just in general, when you go for your annual checkup, you got to tell your healthcare provider what you're on so they can start weighing the risks and benefits for your particular case. So we used to say 4,000, that above 4,000 milligrams of calcium per day is probably unreasonable. Some docs pull that all the way down to 2,000. What I try to remind my patients is think about what's in your food. Even a potato has 60 of calcium. So somewhere between that 2,000 and 4,000 level is probably reasonable. But for patients with osteoporosis, we do want you to get 1,500.
Okay, and when you're talking about calcium intake, you're talking milligrams, like 2,000 milligrams?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And
so 2,000 milligrams is 2 grams. So just so everybody's clear on that.
Okay. Piatt County is the next caller, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask a question about loss of bladder control. I developed this horrible cold, and I'm in my 60s. And I noticed when I sneezed, I had some loss of bladder control, which I'd never noticed before, ever. But I also have, within the past year, finished chemo for colon cancer. So I was wondering if loss of bladder control is a natural progression of age, or if it could be related to chemo and radiation. Just wondering.
About 20% of women, after they have a child, have some form of stress incontinence mm-hmm. that tends to improve, particularly if they do Kegels exercise over time. And then as we get older, there are two components of bladder control, and one is nerve and one is anatomic. Mm-hmm. And as we get older, we do have some worsening of the anatomy. Our pelvic floor, and it's punctuated by the urethra, by the vagina, and by the rectum. And our pelvic floor is a giant sling, many layers of the sling, actually. And the different layers can actually weaken, and various components can herniate through. And that is the basis of the anatomic loss of support. Mm-hmm. And some of the sling is collagen, and that's the hernia, and some of the layers of sling are muscular, and that's where the Kegels exercises can build up the muscle, just like lifting weights can, you know, build up your arm muscles. And some patients have a loss due to some nerve function. Some patients have a loss due to these hernias. Some patients have a loss due to lack of Kegels, actually sex, is one form of exercise. Mm-hmm. So there's a little sex prescription for us. And it is true when we get sick and actually have a cold or a flu in our system, it can make it worse temporarily. There was a fascinating new study just published very recently that they were looking at the progression over time and how fast these anatomic defects progressed. And they actually found a small percentage of patients, they get better, which was news to me and many. And they put that article in our continuing education kinds of credits. And it was the first time any study had actually showed that. So it'll have to be confirmed by future study. It is known that once you have certain hernias, these have to be corrected. And so examination by a gynecologist is usually indicated to figure out where you stand on all of this. And is this something that needs correction or not? There are surgeries that can be done literally with just suture stitches that we've used for 100 years practically that only work modestly well. And now we have surgeries that are very quick, nifty surgeries with meshes that some physicians still label experimental because they've only been used for in the 5 to 10 year range. And have a little bit higher complication rate in the general surgeon's hands, the average gynecologist's hands than in the expert's hands, but really have revolutionized the technology. And we generally just kind of ballpark recommend surgeries for people who have to wear pads fairly regularly because of this urine leakage. Now, whether or not chemotherapy per se can cause a worsening of these conditions, we think that in some patients they worsen when they have lack of estrogen. So to the extent that chemotherapy has reduced your hormones, yeah, could be somewhat tied, but that's a couple steps away, not necessarily chemotherapy related, but that becomes a very individualized kind of scenario that probably you'd have to work through with your own physician.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your help.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. So for people who don't know what it is, what's the Kegels exercise?
Well, it's basically a tightening of all those muscles. So we usually, to teach people the Kegels exercise, we say it's like trying to stop the stream of urine as you try to urinate, as you are actually urinating. And for many people, they say, oh, I couldn't do that. Well, you don't really have to stop the stream of urine. You just, it's the attempt. And Dr. Cagle, a male, recommended doing this about 300 times a day. And that keeps a woman fairly busy. So we're supposed to do our Kegels exercises as we drive in our car and talk on the phone and talk on the radio or whatever. And they've refined Kegels exercises so that you can perform the contraction slowly and hold for a few seconds and relax, or fast and relax and fast and relax and do as many as you can. And we usually teach our pregnant patients these exercises, and most of my patients, when I say, have you been doing your Kegels, they're like, oh yeah, I forgot. So most women, when they go through a pregnancy, do get taught these exercises and have done them. And for most women, they will help, but for someone who truly needs surgical correction, they're not going to replace surgery.
All right. We're coming down to the point. We have maybe 2-3 minutes left. Is there another subject you might like to talk a little bit about?
Well, I could talk a little bit about some of the newer skin technology. There has traditionally been to resurface skin and eliminate wrinkles, the technology of using CO2 carbon dioxide lasers has been used in the past, and that caused a lot of scarring and downtime. And what of course is a cosmetic procedure, but it does have some health benefits in terms of changing over precancerous conditions that lead to the small kinds of localized skin cancers, but it would lead to a lot of redness of the face, open wounds that could last up to 2 weeks, redness of the face that could last up to 2 or 3 months, or even up to 1 year. And now they've revolutionized this technology using the YAG and erbium lasers and fractionated the technology, so beams that are delivered in little pinpoint beams looking much like the amount of that a pinpoint might create, and in a very localized area, so that the wounds that are created literally start re-epithelializing in about 12 hours and then heal over in about 3 to 5 days. And so the redness persists for maybe a week and heal in. And that's what's been new in terms of resurfacing the skin. It's an ablative type of laser. They've started using these kinds of lasers to resurface scars, tighten stretch marks, soften surgical scars, and it's been quite a revolution. And what has been talked about a lot, they started using it on the creepy skin on the abdomen and old surgical kinds of scars on the knees, on the nose where they've excised basal cells. It's been a very interesting development, and surgeons of all walks, from gynecology to general surgery to dermatology to plastics, are now using these technologies, and it's been very exciting development.
So this is a thing that you would use on a specific, relatively small area. It's not the kind of thing
on your whole face. Of course, that's elective, and it's somewhat expensive technology. Or you can use it on a specific area as well.
All right. Well, we're just about at the point where we have to finish up. Maybe just going back, I was going to ask you back when you were talking about osteoporosis. Again, remind us in terms of what the suggestion is for to having a kind of a baseline test of your bone density. When and what is what?
If I had my druthers, I would have women all at age 40. A lot of doctors have a bone density test starting at age 50 or the age of menopause. Some organizations don't test a patient's bones till age 65 unless there is a risk factor, but probably age 50 is the time to get a bone density test.
Okay. Well, our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist with Women's Health Practice. She also teaches at U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. Every other month, usually on a Monday, she's here. We talk about Women's Health. Thanks very much.
Thank you.